You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
All right, please. Just for a good session. I'm Stephen Boyce. Thank you.
Thank you. Please be seated. Bailiff, if we could have the jurors brought in, please.
All right.
Front of the jury is present and accounted for.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. Please be seated. All right. Good morning, everyone. We're back on the record on KCR 22-211623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. Defendants present as well as counsel for the defense. The state's present. Court notes all jurors are also present and properly seated. The courts received the juror affirmation signed by each of the jurors. Thank you again for continuing to follow the court's admonishing instruction as we break each day. And with that, the state is continuing with its case in chief, and I believe has another witness to call this morning. Who's going to be examining the witness?
I will be, Your Honor.
Okay, Ms. Blake, you can call your next witness.
The state will call Dr. Lily Marsden.
You're welcome.
The testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, to help you, God.
Sit close enough to speak directly into the mic. You have water right there, and this is a laser.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. I'll note now the witness has been sworn. Before we begin with direct examination, I just have a couple of questions for the witness. Dr. Marsden, have you been watching or viewed any of the trial testimony that's taken place in this case?
I have not.
Okay, have you discussed with anyone else the testimony they've given at trial?
No.
All right, thanks for your responses, Ms. Blake. You may inquire on direct.
Thank you. Would you please state your name and spell it for the record?
My name is Lily Marsden, L-I-L-Y. M-A-R-S-D-E-N.
Dr. Marsden, where are you currently employed?
I am currently employed at the Utah Office of the Medical Examiner.
What is your title or position?
Right now, I am the Deputy Chief Medical Examiner.
How long have you worked in that position?
In this position, I've been the Deputy Chief for approximately a year.
Did you work at the Office of the Utah Medical Examiner prior to that?
Yes.
What other positions have you held in that office?
So I was also the forensic pathology fellow during my training year and then was an assistant medical examiner after that.
Prior to working at the Office of the Utah Medical Examiner, did you have other experience as a pathologist?
Yes.
What was that?
So I was the autopsy pathologist and medical director for Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois.
Do you have any specialized training in order to be a forensic pathologist?
I do.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So the training to become a forensic pathologist starts with an undergraduate degree in college. After that, we go to medical school and finish a four-year medical degree. We then receive a training program in anatomic and clinical pathology, which is 4 years. After that, I additionally did a year of pediatric and perinatal pathology in Chicago before starting as an autopsy pathologist for Northwestern. And then I did a year of forensic pathology fellowship training after that before starting as a forensic pathologist.
And when you worked at Northwestern as a pathologist, was it in a different capacity than what you do now?
Yes.
And can you explain a little bit about that?
So at Northwestern, there is a significant difference between hospital autopsy and forensic autopsy. So with hospital autopsies, our primary goal is to diagnose the natural disease processes that people have when they die in a hospitalized setting. And so I was doing autopsies both on fetuses, neonates, and adults who had been admitted to the hospital or had died in a medical setting.
At some point while working at the Office of the Utah Medical Examiners, are you aware of that office being contacted by Fremont County, Idaho law enforcement?
Yes.
And did you end up attending an exhumation of Tammy Daybell?
I did.
Had you heard of Tammy or Tamara Daybell prior to that?
No.
And you did, in fact, attend the exhumation?
I did.
Did you either follow or were in close proximity with the body for transport to your office?
I was.
And at the time that that autopsy was conducted, were you a fellow?
Yes.
And which doctor were you working with? Was there one specific or were there several?
During my fellowship, I worked with all of the forensic pathologists who were employed by the office.
And did that include a Dr. Eric Christensen?
It did.
Did you, in fact, conduct the autopsy alongside Dr. Christensen?
I did.
As you conducted the autopsy, did the two of you discuss your findings?
Yes.
And what was your relationship with Dr. Christensen?
So during my fellowship, Dr. Christensen was my supervising physician. Before I started my fellowship, I had known Dr. Christensen as a colleague, both because of my work at Northwestern and because I was a resident at the University of Utah and had experience with the medical examiner's office and Dr. Christensen.
Is it fair to say, as you conducted the autopsy and reviewed things, that you were able to form your own opinion?
Yes.
Did you discuss that opinion with Dr. Christensen?
Yes.
And I've used the term performed an autopsy. Can you tell us, did you in fact perform an autopsy of Tammy Daybell?
I did.
Can you talk us through the autopsy process?
So autopsies vary depending on the type of case that we have. So in a case such as this, where there were suspicious circumstances that led to her exhumation, there are different things that we do. So as soon as the body arrives in our office, they receive an x-ray so that we can see if there is any potential natural disease we can diagnose by x-ray, as well as traumatic injuries to the skeletal structure. After we review the x-ray, we then perform an external examination of the body. This is to, again, document any potential natural disease processes that we may be able to see from the outside, as well as any traumatic injuries that may have been inflicted or sustained on the body. After an external examination is performed, if there's trace evidence that needs to be collected, we will do that. We will then do an internal examination where we dissect all of the major organs to look for any natural disease processes, any traumatic injuries, anything that could explain why a person has become deceased.
And kind of breaking it down, when you started with the external examination of Tammy, did you notice anything?
So Tammy, of course, had been embalmed previously and had been interred. So she had the findings that we see related to embalming and incision near the neck for embalming, as well as a puncture in her abdomen where more embalming fluid is infused. She also had, you know, the changes that you see with internment. So she had various molds that had unfortunately been growing on her body. And then in addition to that, she had some contusions, or what that's the technical term for a bruise, on her chest and on her arms.
Through the external examination, did you find any noticeable or immediate cause of death?
No.
Your Honor, I would ask to be handed State's Exhibit 178, and if we may approach briefly.
Yes.
And after performing that external, what next steps did you take?
So after her external examination, we did the general Y incision that we do to open the torso so that we can examine all the major organs. We then remove all of the organs, weigh them, and dissect them to look for any potential cause of death, whether that be natural, traumatic. Then we open the head, we do an incision through the scalp that can be easily hidden, and then open the skull cap to remove the brain, which is then placed in a fixative so that it can be dissected at a later date more thoroughly so that we're not rushing.
And as you went through that process, did a cause of death become apparent for Tammy Daybell?
No.
Did you find anything abnormal or anything that caught your attention in doing that internal exam?
The only thing abnormal we really found on Tammy's examination was that she had a lot of fluid in her lungs, which we call pulmonary edema, and she had a foamy fluid in her airways, so her trachea and her larger bronchi.
What could possibly cause pulmonary edema?
So pulmonary edema is very nonspecific. It essentially occurs anytime a person is experiencing respiratory failure for whatever cause. There are multiple causes, both natural and non-natural, that can result in pulmonary edema. Natural things that can cause pulmonary edema are things like congestive heart failure or a pneumonia, both of which I was not able to see on Tammy Daybell. Non-natural causes, we are frequently seeing with drug overdoses, anything that causes asphyxia, drownings, and those are the things that I think of off the top of my head when I see that.
Did you find any other injuries or signs consistent with any of those potential causes immediately?
No.
What were your next steps after performing that internal part of the autopsy?
So while we're doing the internal examination, we're obtaining samples for potential toxicology testing. So for samples, just in general, the best sample that we can get is blood. Unfortunately, in somebody who's been embalmed, most of the blood has been removed from the body in the embalming process and replaced with embalming fluid, which is a mixture of different volatile compounds like formaldehyde, alcohol, methanol. So, you know, we get what we can from vessels, which is essentially just a mixture of the blood that's left and embalming fluid. And then we also obtain liver tissue, which we have a fair number of standards for as far as comparisons of lethal to therapeutic levels. And then we get some eye fluid, which is relatively well preserved during the embalming process. And then in her bladder was intact, so we were also able to get urine.
What did you do with those samples that you were able to collect, if anything?
So the samples were sent to labs for various testing, and we used two labs to do our toxicology testing. We used a reference lab in Pennsylvania that does a very large amount of forensic toxicology testing called NMS Labs. And then because of the circumstances around the case, we also involved the Utah Chemical Threat Response Lab to do some specialized testing in things that aren't normally tested for.
What, if anything, were the results of those tests?
So based on everything that was ordered, the only thing that we really found in Tammy's system was fluoxetine, which was an antidepressant that she was known to have been prescribed for many years. And that was detected in her liver tissue at a reported therapeutic level.
Did you find any explanation or anything to explain the cause of death?
Not with toxicology.
Once that toxicology was ruled out and there was no immediate cause to be seen, what did you next consider as possible causes?
So when we have negative autopsies like this, so it's not an autopsy that's completely normal, but there is no cause of death that we're able to see. There's a few things that we have to consider. So we consider, seizure disorders. We consider cardiac arrhythmias. And as far as non-natural causes, we consider asphyxia. So we have to really take a look at all of these possibilities and see what is the most likely and what can essentially be ruled out. So in Tammy Daybell's case, we initially got some information at first that she had been having some minor shaking fits that looked like seizure activity. So we had our neuropathologist examine the brain very thoroughly to see if there was any possible reason why she could be having seizures. It is extremely unusual for a 49-year-old woman to just spontaneously start developing seizures without some anatomic reason, like a tumor or a brain bleed or something like that. And we just weren't able to find anything. The other thing that we think about are cardiac arrhythmias. So with cardiac arrhythmias, so abnormal heartbeats in the heart that can lead to sudden death, these, again, are very unusual in a 49-year-old who has no history of palpitations or anything that has been evaluated by a physician. So her heart was structurally normal. It was the normal size. It did not have dilated chambers. All of her valves were normal. So there was really no great reason why she would be experiencing a cardiac arrhythmia at this time of her life without anything preceding it. After that, we're left with asphyxia. And asphyxia is a diagnosis of exclusion. And in our opinion, we did thoroughly exclude the other potential causes of death with a negative autopsy.
And when we talk about being left with asphyxia, is that what you ultimately determined to be the cause of death?
We did.
What did you determine to be the manner of death?
Manner of death in this case was homicide.
How many types of manners do you consider?
So we have five manners of death that we get to choose from.
And what are those?
So there is natural, which is death by a natural disease process. Accident, which is death from an accidental external factor. Suicide, which is death by one's own volitional act. And homicide, which is death by the act of another person. And then if after the autopsy and examination, we don't have enough information to make a determination, we have a category that is cannot be determined.
Have you ever conducted an autopsy where you determine the manner to be undetermined?
Yes.
Have you conducted other autopsies where you determine the manner to be homicide?
Yes.
Do you know approximately how many autopsies you've conducted?
In my career, I've conducted approximately 2,000 autopsies.
And if we now go back to that cause of death being asphyxia, are there various ways that someone can die from asphyxiation?
Yes.
What are some of those?
So I separate asphyxia into four general categories. So the first is exclusion of oxygen. So the airway is obstructed by something. Examples of this would be like choking, drowning, having a bag placed over the face or over the head to exclude oxygen. The second category that we see the most in my line of work is neck compression. So this would be things like hanging. Then we have chemical asphyxia, which is there is some type of chemical that is displacing oxygen on your red blood cells. So that's like carbon monoxide poisoning or cyanide poisoning. And then the last is a mechanical asphyxia, where there is some weight that's on the chest that's not allowing it to rise and or allowing a person to breathe.
So with that last category, could that asphyxia be a cause that's linked to the manner being homicide?
It could be.
And again, we talked about the bruising that you observed. Do you recall where it was on Ms. Daybell's body?
So Ms. Daybell had one bruise on the left side of her chest. She had one bruise on her left arm, and then she had a cluster of bruises on her right arm.
In your opinion, could those be consistent with someone being restrained?
Yes.
Could they be consistent with someone having pressure applied?
Yes.
Did you do anything to attempt to determine the age of those bruises?
Yes.
And what did you do?
So we took samples of the bruises to look at under the microscope. And when we did this, we're looking for, you know, what causes the color of the bruise, which is hemorrhage or bleeding into the skin from the ruptured blood vessels. And then we're looking at any type of inflammatory response that the body is mounting to try to clean up all of the hemorrhage.
And what were you able to determine, if anything, in relation to the bruises on Tammy Daybell?
So all of the bruises on Ms. Daybell were what we would call acute, which meant that under the microscope, the only thing there was bleeding into the soft tissues under the skin. So there was no inflammatory response. So the body had not started to mount a response to try to clean up the injury.
What, if anything, were you able to determine in relation to the age of the bruising based on that?
So I would consider these perimortem bruises, which would mean that they occurred probably within a couple hours of her death to maybe a few minutes after her death.
Did you observe any lividity on Ms. Daybell's body?
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit about what lividity is?
So lividity is a postmortem change that happens in the body when the blood stops circulating. So when your heart's not beating anymore and blood is not circulating through your body, it kind of just falls with gravity. So whatever the position a person is in, all of the blood that's in your blood vessels just starts to settle. And so it settles to those lowest dependent portions that are closest to the floor just because of gravity.
Where, if Where did you observe the lividity on Tammy's body?
On Tammy's body, it was a little bit more difficult to see because, again, she was embalmed. So much of the blood and her body had been removed. But she did still have some lividity on her back and her posterior surfaces.
And mentioning the embalming, does that create issues in conducting an autopsy?
It can.
In this case, did you feel that it affected your ability to perform the autopsy?
No.
Did it have an impact on your ability to determine the manner of death?
No.
And have you ever, are you familiar with the coroner systems?
Yes.
And can you explain a little bit about the difference between a coroner and a medical examiner?
Sure. So a medical examiner is a forensic pathologist. So they are physicians who go through medical training and then specialize training in pathology and forensic pathology to do what they do. Coroners are often either elected or appointed to a position where they are in some ways doing the same thing as a medical examiner, but not always with the same level of education.
And in your experience, is it fair to say coroners don't even have to have any medical training?
In some places, they do not.
And you work in Utah, correct?
Correct.
And is that a medical examiner system?
Yes.
Are you, as part of that office, tasked with determining whether or not an autopsy should be conducted?
Yes.
And does that include for unattended deaths?
Yes.
Can you explain what an unattended death is?
So in Utah, an unattended death is an individual who passes away when they are not under the routine care of a physician. So in Utah, we consider attended deaths if you are being treated for a lethal chronic medical condition within a year of you passing away. So if you have not seen a doctor for a year and pass away at home, that would be considered an unattended death, and those would be considered the jurisdiction of our office.
When you're determining whether or not to get an autopsy, do you consider additional factors?
Yes.
Does that include police reports?
It can.
Can it include witness statements?
Yes.
Does it include medical records?
Yes.
In regards to Tammy Daybell, did you in fact look at those types of documents?
Some of them before the autopsy and then additional afterwards.
And I talked about in terms of requesting an autopsy, do you also look at those in assisting in determining a cause and manner of death?
Absolutely.
And did you do that in this case?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what rigor mortis is?
So rigor mortis is, like lividity, again, a postmortem change. So when you stop breathing, all the oxygen that's currently in the body gets used up by your muscles until your muscles become stiff. And then once that happens, you usually continue to stay stiff until decomposition starts to break that down.
Are you able to determine a specific time of death based on rigor mortis?
No.
Does it assist in providing a time frame?
It could.
If a body is described as stiff and cold, would that indicate anything to you?
If they are being described as stiff and cold, what I would consider is that they've likely been deceased for a couple hours, but I would also be asking more questions of my investigators. What do you mean by stiff? Is it stiff in just her jaw? Is it stiff in her arms and her legs and her hips? Because that stiffening happens as a progression, starting with the smaller muscles and then going to the larger muscles. And so I would be asking my investigators more specifically, what are you meaning by stiff? And then that would give me more of a time frame that I can work with. But if somebody just says stiff to me, I would usually say a couple hours, but I can't be more specific than that.
And in the case of Tammy Daybell, is it fair to say you were not on scene initially when her death was reported?
No.
When we talk about those bruises on Tammy's body, if someone's stiff or been dead for a few hours, would something cause bruising to the body at that point?
Judge, speculation, objection.
She's an expert. I'm asking her expert opinion.
It's overruled.
Sorry, will you repeat the question?
Yes. If someone's been described as stiff and potentially dead for a few hours, would you expect that body to be bruised by some kind of external factor at that point?
Not at that point.
And when we talk about the various ways that asphyxia can occur, Can some of those not leave any external signs?
Absolutely.
Can some of them not leave very many internal signs?
Absolutely.
Is one of the internal signs of asphyxiation the pulmonary edema?
It can be.
And in this case, did you review some medical records associated with Tammy Daybell?
I did.
Did you see anything in the medical records that would explain her sudden death?
No.
Do you recall seeing anything in the medical records about seizure activity?
No.
Do you recall seeing anything about low blood pressure?
Nothing that was reported as a diagnosis. I did review her vital signs for multiple medical visits in probably the decade before she passed away. And she had some low normal blood pressure readings, but it was never discussed as a problem with her physician.
And would you expect someone that had a prior history of anemia to just suddenly pass away?
No.
Would you, or in your experience, expect someone using homeopathic medicines or remedies to just suddenly pass away?
No.
And again, in your prior work at Northwestern, would you have been conducting autopsies that would have been attended deaths?
Yes.
And those would be deaths where someone was under the care of a doctor?
Exactly.
And deaths where someone had some kind of a medical issue?
Yes.
And I ask you about those bruises and not expecting to see them on a body that had been deceased for a few hours. Can you explain a little bit about why you wouldn't expect to see bruising?
So when a person passes away, blood stops flowing through your vessels. And the reason why a bruise occurs in a living person is a force causes rupture of the blood vessels under the skin. And because your heart is pumping blood, the blood is exiting those ruptured vessels and accumulating in those tissues under the skin. So that is what causes a bruise. So a person who's deceased, who doesn't have blood pressure, who doesn't have blood circulating through their system, if those blood vessels are ruptured from a trauma after somebody is deceased, there's not going to be a lot of blood that is leaking out into the tissues because there's not blood flowing through those vessels.
And so, again, the bruises on Tammy in this case, you determined would have occurred sometime around her time of death.
True.
And you talked about asphyxia kind of essentially getting there by ruling other causes out. Is that fair?
Yes.
When we talk about the seizures, any indication in Tammy's medical history that made you think that was a plausible explanation or likely cause of her death?
No. And there's a number of reasons why I think seizures are an extremely unlikely and unplausible explanation for her death. So most people who have a seizure disorder and who die of their seizure disorder, they are not minor shaking fits. They're not minor seizures that these people are having. They're usually grand mal shaking seizures that are not subtle. And so to not have a history of any type of seizure like that and to suddenly develop it as a 49-year-old woman with no explanation in the brain for a seizure for a seizure focus just does not make any sense.
And then talking a little more about the cardia arrhythmia, did you see anything in Tammy's medical history or with her heart that would lead you to believe that was a likely cause of death or plausible?
No, Tammy's heart was completely normal at the time of examination.
And then we talked about the different manners of death. Did you consider undetermined as a potential option?
We did.
What did you ultimately determine the manner of death to be?
It was homicide.
And again, the cause of death?
Is it asphyxia?
And if I may have just one moment.
You may.
I have no further questions, Your Honor.
All right. I have a question, Ms. Blake. You had discussed or potentially offered in Exhibit 178. Are we not? Is that being offered or not? I need to clarify.
No, Your Honor. It's already been admitted into the record. I'm just not republishing it.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification, Ms. Blake. All right. Once you're ready, Mr. Pryor, you can cross-examine.
Good morning, Dr. Marsden.
Morning.
You mentioned that you're currently working at the Utah Medical Examiner's Office out of, is that Salt Lake City, Utah?
Correct.
Okay. Do you have a recollection of what day Tammy Daybell was exhumed?
I believe it was December 11th, 2019.
And your examination took how long that day?
I cannot remember off the top of my head, but it was likely 2 to 3 hours.
Okay. And you were present for the exhuming of Tammy's body, is that right?
Correct.
Were you also present at the time when they reburied Tammy as well?
No, I was not.
And are you aware that whether or not they reburied her the same day that they exhumed her?
That was my understanding by the court order that that was required.
Okay. And being present, did you see anybody from the family who was present for that process?
No.
Okay. You mentioned that you were contacted by the Fremont County Police Department regarding this matter?
I was not. The office was.
Do you have a recollection or knowledge as to when they contacted your office?
I don't. I was not involved in that process at the time.
You mentioned the subject of suspicious circumstances as to why they exhumed her body. You testified that because of the suspicious circumstances. What suspicious circumstances were you referring to?
The ones that we were told was that there were some missing children that had been reported by other family members, and that the decedent's husband had recently remarried a person who was being, who people were saying they were in a relationship with before she had passed away.
So there wasn't any suspicion regarding what was surrounding actual going on with Tammy Daybell. It was all of the collateral circumstances about Mr. Daybell being in a relationship with another woman and some other matters that were being investigated. Is that correct?
Objection, Your Honor. Counsel's misstating testimony.
Sustained.
And move to strike that question.
The question should be stricken, not considered by the jury.
So the circumstances that you spoke about were the investigation of the missing children, correct?
Correct.
And to your knowledge, that had nothing to do with Tammy Daybell. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. The fact that Mr. Daybell and Lori Vallow were in an affair relationship, that didn't reflect any physical signs of any foul play with Tammy Daybell, did it?
It was suspicious mostly because she was a 49-year-old woman who was in good health leading up to her death, which was unexplained by the coroner on the death certificate.
But the coroner had explained that this wasn't a homicide. You saw that, correct?
Correct.
And the coroner determined that there was no autopsy. They made the determination not to perform an autopsy. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, the bruises that you spoke of, when someone uses the term, they're not specific. Can you explain to me what you mean by a bruise is not specific?
So a bruise is not specific just because, you know, there's usually not a pattern to it. So we really don't know with any degree of certainty what produced the bruise.
And isn't it true? There really is no empirical way to determine when exactly a bruise is placed on a body.
With any specificity, yeah.
Right. So we can't really tell to a certainty or specificity when those bruises actually occurred on Tammy Daybell's body, correct?
We could give a general time range, but not a specific time.
And even that time range is a subjective determination, isn't that true?
Yes.
In other words, you can't be certain when those bruises were placed on Tammy's body or how they were placed, isn't that correct?
Correct. Okay.
On the subject of heavy lungs, one of your associates, Dr. Christensen, who you worked with on this, made some mention of heavy lungs. And explain to me what—
Objection, Your Honor. Misstates testimony, calls for speculation.
Sustained.
Have you heard of the term heavy lungs?
Yes.
Did you observe or make a determination that there was a medical situation here that's consistent with heavy lungs?
So heavy lungs does not necessarily indicate a medical situation. It's just a description of how heavy the lungs are.
Okay. But there are underlying medical conditions that can be related to a determination that the lungs are heavy. Isn't that true?
There can be, which is why we do microscopic examination of the lungs. Okay.
Now, at the time of this autopsy, you were working as a fellow with—
Correct.
Dr. Christensen.
Correct.
And was this your first autopsy outside of a laboratory environment?
No.
Okay. How many autopsies had you done prior to this?
Approximately 500.
And were those autopsies all under the supervision of another physician or medical examiner?
No, only the ones that I performed at the Office of the Medical Examiner.
You mentioned that the stomach contained a substantial amount of foam.
Not the stomach, the airways.
The airways. I'm sorry. I don't know why I put down stomach.
And it wasn't a substantial amount, but there was foam still present.
And that was after Tammy had been exhumed. Is that correct?
Correct.
So in other words, either the foam continued or it was that way when she was prepared for burial, correct?
Correct.
Okay. You talked about natural causes of death. And you said pulmonary and seizures, I recall. Again, could you describe to me what are the natural causes of death that could be unexplained in a situation like this?
So the natural causes of death that you would think about when you have, quote, negative autopsy, an autopsy where there is no discernible cause of death, are going to be things like seizures or cardiac heart rhythm disorders.
Right. And when you're talking about, and I wrote down pulmonary because it's heart rhythm disorders. Maybe that was my shortcut. Heart rhythm disorders. When you have a situation where there's no identifiable cause of death, including a completely healthy heart, you can still have cardiac arrhythmias, correct?
You can.
And you could still have a manner of death that included the heart just stopping its functioning process without any explanation as to the whether there's damage to the heart or not, correct?
Correct.
So when we talk about foam, and I was about to say the stomach again, but when we talk about foam that was in the airways and the lungs, one of the indications of foam, isn't it true, is that the heart stops and doesn't provide enough oxygen to the body, and the result is a significant amount of foam?
Usually it's that the heart isn't functioning appropriately for an extended period of time that's leading to respiratory failure, which is causing accumulation of fluid in the lungs. Usually when you have a sudden cardiac death, you don't have enough time for that pulmonary edema to develop because your lungs are essentially stopping at the same time that your heart is stopping.
So if I understand you correctly, then that if there's a sign that the heart isn't working properly, regardless of whether there are signs or not, though of an unhealthy heart, that's when you're going to get that foam situation, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So I guess my question is this, is that if in fact Tammy Daybell's heart was immediately stopped by compression or asphyxiation, that's an immediate stopping of the heart. Why is there foam in her system then?
Well, asphyxia isn't going to immediately stop the heart. The heart will stop once it's not able to get enough oxygen to continue to pump. And that's going to take minutes if a person is being asphyxiated. And then that will allow time for the lungs to start to fail and fluid to accumulate.
Or it could be that the heart wasn't functioning properly and it stopped and foam developed within her system as a result of a heart that wasn't working properly, correct?
So what you're describing is congestive heart failure. And in that case, when we look at the lungs under the microscope, we see other evidence of congestive heart failure, which is usually old bleeding into the lungs from leaky vessels, which causes macrophages or the inflammatory cells to come in and clean it up. And that was not seen in her. So this was not a congestive heart failure.
But when you come up with a determination that the death is undetermined and there's absolutely no signs, let's say there's no bruising, let's say there is nothing indicating any sort of cause of death, and yet we have someone who's passed away, you make an undetermined, that in that situation, without any signs or any other collateral information, you make a determination that it's an undetermined death, correct?
If you have no other collateral information, investigative information that leads you to any other conclusion.
And when you make a determination of an undetermined death and there's no indication of any cause of death, you just may never know. The person just died. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And in a situation where the person just dies, you could have an absolutely healthy heart, correct?
You can.
You can have an absolutely healthy lung, correct?
Correct.
You can have absolutely healthy organs in every single manner, and yet the person can still die, correct?
Correct.
And that's not limited to someone who's 49 years old. That could be an athlete on a basketball court who passes away suddenly without any notice of anything or any sign of any damage or disease, correct?
Could be.
And that athlete could be a 17-year-old athlete playing in a basketball game and suddenly just passes away and that would be an undetermined death, correct?
Not necessarily. It depends on the autopsy. And in that kind of case, especially with a young person like that, that is where we start to think about genetic arrhythmia disorders, and we would do genetic testing.
And what that means is that you would be looking back at their past as to whether or not there's any family history of any heart issues or anything like that, correct?
Correct.
And in this particular situation, there was a notation on her medical records which indicated that Tammy Daybell's family had some heart issues that were listed and noted on her medical records. You recall that?
I do.
Okay. Now, on the issue of asphyxia, you talked about the bruises on her arms, and the vast majority of them were on the right arm. Is that correct?
Correct.
There were a number of them that you're claiming are bruises were on the right arm, and then one on the left, right?
Yes.
And then a mark on her chest?
Yes.
Okay. So you talked about what you claim are the four levels of asphyxia. And the first one you mentioned would have been exclusion of oxygen by way of choking, correct?
It could be exclusion of oxygen by anything.
Now, in Tammy Daybell's situation, there was no sign of any broken or malfunctioning airway that had been blocked physically. Is that correct?
Correct.
You didn't see any damage to the neck or the throat or any of the, and I'm going to hack the bone that's called
the hyoid.
Thank you. I'll never get it right. I could practice and I'll never get it right. That wasn't cracked or broken or anything like that, correct?
No, there was damage to the muscles on the right because of the embalming process. So we weren't able to do a full examination, but there was nothing on the left.
Okay. And then you talked the second one would have been neck compression.
Yes.
And there were no indications of any bruising or fingerprints or marks suggesting that Tammy Daybell was choked or someone had squeezed her neck to cause her to die that way, correct?
Correct.
And then the next one you mentioned was chemical asphyxiation, and there's no indication. You did an extensive review of potential chemicals that could have caused this, correct?
Correct.
And the only thing you came up with was the fluoxetine, which was the medication she was taking, correct?
Correct.
And did you do a cross-check as to whether or not any of these homeopathic or any of these essential oils or other items could potentially interact in a way that could cause her some medical issues?
So most of the essential oils and homeopathic medications that are out there have low overdose potential. There's still a potential for overdose, but because of that, testing for those things is not offered in most reference labs. And so we wouldn't have been able to rule any of that out, but there was no evidence at the scene that she was overtaking any of these things.
Okay. And you don't know the quantity of those homeopathic medicines or the oils or the other things that she was taking, correct?
No.
And if you were to make a determination and you did have that, would that aid you in maybe considering that as a possible option?
It could.
Okay. Now, the last one you mentioned was a mechanical asphyxiation. And I don't know if this one falls into the subject of you cover up the mouth or you cover up the chest physically with something to stop the breathing. Is that what that is about?
So exclusion of oxygen would be something that covers the mouth, covers the nose or airway. So that would be like a suffocation. With mechanical asphyxia, we see mechanical asphyxias very frequently. And so the classic situation is somebody who's working under their car and the car jack fails and the car falls on the chest and then the chest is no longer able to rise. Those people die of a mechanical asphyxia.
And the type of asphyxia you're talking about is the stoppage of the breathing. Tammy Daybell, someone was trying to stop. That's what you're suggesting, is someone was trying to stop Tammy Daybell from breathing, physically covering up her airway. Is that correct?
Correct.
So explain to me, with the bruises on the arms, did you see any scratches on the fingers or any sign of any DNA under the fingers?
So in this case, she had been prepared for burial. She had been washed, cleaned, and there was also mold on her fingers from the internment. So at this point, there would be no trace evidence.
And there were no scratches of any kind that would indicate any kind of a struggle. Is that correct?
Correct.
Nothing, in fact, to indicate any kind of a struggle, correct?
The bruises could indicate a struggle, but it's, again, nonspecific.
And when you say nonspecific, we don't know how those bruises got there, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So if someone's holding Tammy's, Daybell's breathing, that same person then at the same time would be holding her arms down as well?
Or there's more than one person. I don't know.
Okay. But the suggestion is that you're saying someone was stopping her breathing, or and potentially there could be another person there who's restraining the arms. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm not suggesting anything, but that is a possibility.
Okay. You talked a little bit about rigor mortis, and when you have a pulmonary edema, that speeds up the process of rigor mortis, does it not?
No.
Okay. When you're talking about stiff and cold, again, that's a subjective determination, correct?
Correct.
You could walk up to somebody and hold their arm and it could be stiff and cold, but that doesn't give you a distinct determination as to when what that means specifically, correct?
Correct.
In fact, unless you're someone in your profession, making that determination the best way is that you're there and you evaluate the level, because that's an advancing determination of when someone starts to become cold, and it increases as time goes on, correct?
Correct.
So if someone makes mention of the fact that something is cold or stiff, that's really doesn't give you any sort of information or determination as to how you would apply that to the time of a cause of death, correct?
Correct.
And again, as far as the cause of death, again, this is a subjective determination by you. You really can't say to any specificity when the cause of death was or had occurred in this case. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
And again, what kind of medical records, which specifically medical records did you review?
I would have to go back and look at the list, but I know that we looked at primary care physician records and urgent care records from 2007 to 2019.
Okay. From when?
2007 to 2019.
And in reviewing the medical records, you never saw any treatment for any low blood pressure or anything like that. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Were you provided information about Tammy Daybell having dizzy spells?
Yes.
And maybe some fainting issues?
Yes.
Okay. Balance issues?
I don't recall balance issues.
Okay. And in terms of the contents of her stomach, you found some, at least what I describe as potatoes or something like potato-like substance in her stomach?
Yeah, she had about 3.5 ounces of a pink liquid that looked like had food substances that appeared to be consistent with potatoes and peanuts.
Judge, that's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Derek?
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Marsden, you were just asked about the stomach contents. You recall that question?
Yes.
Do contents in a stomach tell you anything one way or the other if someone's thrown up?
No.
And you talked about seeing remnants of potatoes and peanuts. Is that what you recall?
That's what it appeared to be.
Did it appear to be a Big Mac?
No.
You were asked about learning that Tammy had dizzy spells or fainting spells. Do you recall that question?
Yes.
Do you recall where that information came from?
That information was from the police report, which was obtained from her husband.
So the only information regarding dizzy or fainting spells came from Chad Daybell?
Correct.
Anything in the medical records that indicated dizziness or fainting spells?
No.
Did it surprise you not to see Tammy's family at the exhumation?
No.
And you were asked about some of the suspicious circumstances involving some missing kids. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Did you learn that those missing kids were Chad's new wife's kids?
Yes, I think I knew that.
And Tammy Daybell was Chad's recently deceased wife?
Yes.
With regard to this idea of heavy lungs, did you find any signs of a medical condition which would cause heavy lungs?
No.
Did you believe that to play into a cause of death in this case?
I think that it is the result of the cause of death. but it is not itself the cause of death.
In looking at the history, Tammy's medical history and her family's medical history that was noted in her records, any concerns in relation to Tammy's heart based on that?
No. And her records, we specifically asked, did not include any sudden cardiac deaths in young individuals in her family that would indicate a genetic cause of heart disease.
And counsel went over with you again, death by essentially asphyxiation by exclusion of oxygen. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Are there ways that someone can cause someone else's death in that manner without leaving any signs or external injuries?
Absolutely.
Are you aware of some of the mechanisms or way a person could asphyxiate someone else without leaving those signs when we're talking about the exclusion of oxygen category?
Yes.
So what are those?
This would include things like smothering with a pillow, putting a bag over the head, putting a weight on the chest so that the chest can't rise. These are all potential things that would not necessarily leave any sign.
And the last one, the weight on the chest, would be mechanical asphyxiation?
Yes.
Would it fall into that? And you were asked about the bruises and indicated it could indicate there was more than one person there. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Could it also indicate someone kneeling on a chest and holding someone down?
Yes.
In reviewing possible causes of death, what did you determine in relation to a seizure as a possible cause?
That it is extremely unlikely and improbable.
What did you determine with regard to cardiarrhythmia as a cause?
The same, extremely unlikely and improbable.
And again, ultimately, what did you determine the cause to be?
Asphyxia.
And what did you determine the manner to be?
Homicide.
In your experience, or would it be fair to say that dead bodies don't generally roll out of bed?
True.
I have no further questions.
All right. Thank you, Judge. Blake.
Could I have recross, please?
On which issue?
On the kneeling issue and the falling out of the bed.
I think those are within the scope of the cross.
I believe those were covered in cross as well, so I'm not going to allow any recross on that. I don't think the redirect went outside the scope to open a new topic, so I'll deny the request for any recross at this point. That will conclude the testimony then of Dr. Marsden, and with her testimony being concluded, is she going to remain under subpoena?
No, Your Honor. She can be released.
On the defense?
I didn't subpoena her, Judge.
Okay. So that concludes your testimony. Thank you for appearing this morning. You can be excused.
Thank you.
State can call us next witness.
The state will call Investigator Ricky Wright.
Judge, that looks like Officer Hermosillo.
That's what I was thinking.
That's who I think it is. Unless Officer Wright is muscled up a little bit. But
They may have gotten a little confused. So if we may have just a moment.
Yes.
I swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes.
All right. I'll note now the witness has been sworn. Before we begin with direct, I want to inquire, Officer Wright, have you watched or viewed in any way any of the testimony that's taken place in this trial since it started?
No, I have not.
Okay. Have you talked to anyone else about testimony they've given at trial?
No, I have not.
Very well. With that in mind, then, Ms. Blake, if you'd like to inquire, you may.
Thank you. Would you please state your name and spell it for the record?
Yes, Rick Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T.
And where are you currently employed?
I am currently employed as a contract special investigator for the FBI in Pocatello.
And what position did you hold prior to that?
Yes, I was a special agent with the FBI.
And for purposes of today, would you prefer investigator or agent?
Investigator is fine, or Mr. Wright is fine.
And how long were you employed with the FBI?
I was a special agent for 24 and a half years.
Do you have or did you receive any specialized training in order to be a special agent?
Yes, I attended the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia in 1997. That's approximately 4 months. And then after that, I was assigned to my first office, which was the Denver Division in Denver, Colorado.
How long did you work in that division?
I worked there for over 21 years.
In addition to the initial training to be a special agent, have you received or did you receive any specialized training?
Yes, after my initial new agents training, I worked a variety of violations throughout my career, primarily criminal matters for the FBI. The FBI is roughly divided in half between criminal investigations and national security investigations. So I worked primarily criminal investigations and received a variety of specialized training in those type of investigations that I conducted.
What were some of the areas that you received specialized training in?
So initially I worked drugs and organized crime cases. And then for a period of about 8.5 years, I worked financial crimes and public corruption. And then for the last 11 years in the Denver division, I worked violent crime and specialized primarily in violent crimes against children. And that was before I transferred to the Pocatello resident agency in late 2018. And once there, I worked more general criminal matters for the FBI there in Pocatello. So throughout that my career, I received specialized training in all those types of investigations, particularly regarding crimes against children, which was much of my career. I received specialized training in responding to missing abducted children, sex trafficking of children, other exploitation of children, international parental kidnappings. And I received that training. Usually most of these trainings were 1 to 5 day trainings, usually once or twice a year. Much of that came from within the FBI, from the Violent Crimes Against Children Unit or the Behavioral Analysis Unit or the Child Abduction Rapid Deployment Teams that the FBI uses for child abductions, or from outside agencies or organizations like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and other law enforcement agencies.
And you indicated in about 2018, you ended up transferring to the Pocatello area?
Yes.
And is that a different division? How is that in relation to where you were at before in Denver?
Yes. So I transferred to the Pocatello Resident Agency of the Salt Lake City Division of the FBI. The Salt Lake City Division is the headquarters. The headquarters is located in Salt Lake City, Utah, and that division covers all of Utah, Idaho, and Montana. The Denver division covered all of Colorado and Wyoming. And so within a division, there are often these satellite offices called resident agencies, as was the case with the Pocatello resident agency being one. Within Idaho, there were 4 resident agencies at that time, one in Pocatello, another in Boise, Lewiston, and Coeur d'Alene, I believe.
And when you transferred to that resident agency in Pocatello, how many agents were employed at that resident agency?
Yes, at that time, there were 5 agents in the Pocatello resident agency. 3 of them did criminal work, which I was one, and the other 2 did national security work. That resident agency covered really all of eastern Idaho, about 17 counties, I believe. Our supervisor for the criminal agents in Pocatello was actually located in Boise, and that was Doug Hart.
At some point while working there in Pocatello, did you become involved in a search for a missing child named JJ Vallow?
Yes, I did.
Can you explain a little bit about why the FBI became involved?
So the FBI was contacted by the Rexburg Police Department about a child missing in their jurisdiction. That was on November 27th of 2019. And I spoke with Lieutenant Ron Ball and I believe Detective Ray Hermosillo from the Rexburg Police Department about that missing child and the circumstances under which he was missing. The FBI assists in missing children cases because of the Federal Kidnapping Act. Under that act, when children are missing because of the potential interstate nature of a kidnapping, it is a potential federal crime. Unfortunately, we usually don't know up front whether a federal crime has been committed or even if there is a kidnapping that has taken place. But because of the time-sensitive nature of those types of investigations, it's necessary to respond right away and allow the FBI's resources to assist with that. And so when they described the circumstances under which Joshua Vallow or JJ Vallow was missing, We believe that met these requirements of the FBI being involved. And generally, when we have a child, we define that as a child of tender years that's missing under suspicious circumstances. We should get involved. And a child of tender years, I believe, is defined as 12 and under.
And did you know how old J.J. Vallo was?
I believe he was 7 at the time.
When you first became involved, did you know anything about Tylee Ryan also being missing?
Shortly thereafter, I became aware that J.J. had a sibling named Tylee Ryan. We did not realize that she was missing from Idaho at that time.
Do you recall approximately when yourself and or the FBI became involved in the search for J.J. Vallo?
Yes, really almost immediately after that that telephone call from the Rexburg Police Department, we offered our assistance and began to communicate with them on how we could provide further assistance. We opened an investigation. I believe we opened it as a police cooperation matter at first, and then within a few days changed that to a kidnapping classification. And I was assigned as the case agent on that. And due to the scope and of the investigation, really the size of the investigation, we actually assigned a second case agent was assigned, and that was Travis Homer, also at the Pocatello RA.
And you'd already talked about being contacted by the Rexburg Police Department. Do you know if there were additional agencies involved in investigations linked to JJ being missing?
Yes, there were some related investigations being conducted by other agencies.
Do you know what those other investigations were looking into?
Yes, I do.
And what were those things?
So Rexburg Police Department, of course, was looking into the JJ being missing, but the Fremont County Sheriff's Office, also in Idaho, was looking at the death of Tammy Daybell. And there were two agencies in Arizona that I became aware of that were looking at incidents in their jurisdiction. That was in the Gilbert Police Department was one, and they were looking into an attempted shooting of Brandon Boudreau, and the Chandler, Arizona Police Department was looking into the death of Charles Vallo.
Would it be fair to say that this turned into a joint investigation?
Yes.
As part, and did you personally become involved in the investigation?
Yes, I did.
Did you become involved in the investigation into Tammy Daybell's death?
Yes, I did.
And then did you also investigate the JJ and Tylee being missing?
Yes.
Did you ultimately assist in investigating their deaths as well?
Yes.
Can you, and I think you indicated that you were assigned or you were the case agent. Can you explain a little bit about what the case agent does?
So really when an investigation is open at the FBI, there's a case agent or sometimes called a case manager that is assigned. Most cases have one case agent and due to their size can be handled by one agent. So the agent has the responsibility for conducting the investigation, whether that's gathering evidence, conducting interviews and so forth. And, but the FBI, that agent can also call upon additional resources. Often that's other agents that may work in the unit, other staff within the office, and also pull up from resources from outside the office, but within the FBI being a national organization, has considerable resources, and that can include administrative, analytical, technical assistance, and so forth.
In this case, did you actually end up requesting some additional assistance?
Yes, I did.
And specifically, did you request assistance in looking at location data associated with Alex Cox or devices associated with him?
Yes, there were a number of devices, digital devices recovered during the course of the investigation. Many of those were processed by the regional computer forensics laboratory in Salt Lake City. As also for many of those digital devices, they were cell phones, and we were able to get records associated with them, including location data. Many of those records went to a member of the FBI's cellular analysis survey team, who reviewed those records and helped us interpret them and review them.
And do you recall specifically which agent from the CAS team looked at the records?
Yes, that was Agent Nick Balance in the Phoenix, Arizona division.
As he would go through that information, would he share it with you?
Yes.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.